Let me just give you some ideas about where I will be drawing information from this afternoon. I brought a couple of things with me. These two books are useful, and I will be drawing from them some, particularly if some of you are doing some teaching in your churches with parents. This one is called The Parent's Handbook, and it's called The Step Program by Dinkmeyer and McKay. This one is especially for children who are up to about age 11. And it really is basically a teacher's manual. The sequel to it is one that's called Step Teen, and it's more appropriate for teenagers, or the examples in it are focused on teenagers. And I wanted to just share these with you. I did not have these ordered in the bookstore, but I do have, they're from American Guidance Service, and I could give you the information to order them if you would be interested. But these are good tools to use, I think. The book that I did have ordered for the bookstore is a very simple one, a very readable one, maybe that's a nicer word to use, called Liberated Parents, Liberated Children by Faber and Maslich. And these two individuals were students of Gounod, or in classes with Gounod, and really are operating out of his framework. This one is full of examples, and I find it very readable, and I thought perhaps this is something that parents might want to take a look at. Yes.
Pardon me, is this going to be a communicating between parents and children?
Yes.
Thank you. We're leaving.
Okay. Would you like to sit down? Okay. You've got a responsibility. I'm really going to focus more on children. Let's talk first of all about why communication is important. Why is communication important between parents and children?
To understand expectations.
Say that to me.
To understand expectations.
All right, to understand expectations would be one way, one thing. What else? Why is communication with your children important, or with your students important? How do we care?
Otherwise, you're wasting your time.
Okay. Wasting your time in what way?
Well, since the children are there and they have learned nothing, you use energy and nothing has been accomplished. I'm thinking in terms of teacher-student now.
All right. But that's probably true with parents, too. I mean, you certainly put a lot of energy into the communications you try to use with your children. Why don't?
To share feelings, to let them know what you're thinking.
Certainly, to share feelings. Communication is very important. A lot of times feelings show, but it's very easy to misinterpret feelings if you don't talk about. I guess I'm thinking a little bit about what is it that we hope to accomplish by communicating with our children. Do you have a goal in mind when you communicate with your children or with your students?
Mutual understanding.
A lot of times it would be mutual understanding.
Find out where they're at so you know where to go from there.
All right, to find out where they are so you'll have a place to go.
To get in.
To give information and to teach. You know, I certainly hope that some of the things that I do are instructive to my children. Let's focus on the second question that I have on the board and think together about some things that you think facilitate communication and some things that you think interfere with communication. Start at the top. Okay, maybe we'll divide this in two like this. And on one side, talk about things that facilitate communication and things that hinder communication. What are some things that you think about your own experiences, what are some things that you think facilitate communication, that make it more possible for it to happen?
Eye contact.
Okay, eye contact is certainly one. I'm going to convert to this, it's a little faster. Okay? Yes.
Not a lot of distractions like television, radio, exciting races.
Exactly. Impossible in your home, right? Okay. Okay? Other things?
Time.
Very good one. Somehow it seems to me that my children have the greatest need to tell me something when I'm in the biggest hurry. It just always seems to happen to me.
I think timing.
Timing, which isn't maybe the same thing.
It's a little different from time.
Mm-hmm. Especially if, you know, the communication relates to a problem. Because at the height of the problem is usually not the right time to talk about.
Meaning, in other words, that the word I use is understood by you as it is understood by me.
Okay. Common language. And with kids, I'm not quite sure sometimes it would mean the same thing. All right?
Keeping your mouth shut so you can listen.
Very good. Shall I say that? I'm going to say it just like you said it. That sounds good.
A lot of people think they're listening when they're talking all the time.
Exactly. Being sure that you really do listen. Yes.
Being non-judgmental.
Very good. That's hard to do. Okay.
I don't know where this fits, but I think a genuine caring and desire is reflected.
Okay, a kind of caring that you communicate, that you let your child know that you care, your students know that you care. Yes.
Hey, you know, certain gestures that you use, that you use, movement of your head or other body movements, can indicate that you are showing interest in being involved.
Or lack of. Right. Okay. Let's move over here for a minute. What are some problems? Some of these are direct corollaries, but can you think of others perhaps that get in the way that wouldn't be just simple opposites? Lack of privacy is one we didn't talk about privacy. It's very often important to talk to one child out of the presence of the other.
Conflicting nonverbal messages.
Yes. Give me an example.
When you say, "I'm not angry with you," but your whole face just
is rigid.
Is tense. And
okay. Fine. Okay. And I hope that as we move along, we will talk more about what to do with that. Blaming.
Interrupting.
Right, interrupting. Perhaps that's a part of not really listening when you think you are, sorry.
The need to always give advice. Or an answer.
Yes.
Belittling.
Okay.
Defensiveness?
Couldn't hear you. Thank you. Defensiveness. On the part of either
parent or child. Yes.
This may be interrupting, but something I do, finishing sentences.
Couldn't you just bite your tongue off so now you just wish you hadn't done? Anything else you think?
Lack of respect.
Did you say that? Lack of respect. Absolutely. That's true between adults.
Lack of confidentiality.
Okay. Yes.
Denying feelings, like saying, oh, you really don't feel that way.
Okay, I'm just going to stick some here on the side. Somebody else had an idea over here.
I don't know if it's the same, but it's to stop listening. They're talking to you, but you stop listening before they're finished.
Okay.
Even if you're not talking, but you stop listening.
Okay, you mentally turn them off. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thinking of them as less than human or less than a friend.
Okay, which I'm going to circle respect, but that has a lot to do with that. You treat children humanely. Okay. Are you comfortable with that? I thought it might be more helpful to begin, I guess, negatively in a sense, by talking about whether or not there were more times in families and in schoolrooms and Sunday schoolrooms when communication is more difficult than other times. What kind of circumstances can lead to communication being, I'm going to leave this up a minute, communication being more difficult? When is it harder?
When something exciting is going to happen.
All right, what do you mean by exciting?
Well, in school, for example, there's some event coming up.
Okay.
And we try to conduct a class right before that. It's usually lost time.
Right, before the pep rally.
They're thinking about something else, in other words.
Exactly. Okay. So other things can get in the way, other
but
exciting
things. That can happen in homes too, if something.
All right.
Before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when you're tired.
All right. When fatigue is a factor.
When you're rushed, there's no time.
When
you're in a rush.
When you're in a hurry, that interferes, certainly.
Before a holiday. Christmas.
Before a holiday, when you're under a lot of pressure.
This is more internal, but when the two parties have different agendas.
Okay. Give me an example.
I'm trying to get ready to go someplace and someone wants to share something with me. Or or maybe if the student is there because they have to be there, but the teacher wants them to learn, but the student is not there to learn. All right.
Good. What about within our families? Are there times, you know, you've said when you were in a hurry or when something exciting is going on, but are there other times that you can think of when it might be more difficult to share with your children?
PMS.
Okay. PMS might be one. Certainly. All right. And a very legitimate one, yes.
Well, this is a little different, but I think there are different personalities even within a family, and it's not always as easy to communicate with certain types of people or certain types of children as with others.
That's true. That's true in our family. I know one of them is much more open than the other one, and we'll share. What I'd like us to consider is that, and I think this relates to some of the things we have been talking about, but not precisely, is that when, and it gets most closely to what you were saying, when people have different agendas, or when there are conflicts between the two people, communication becomes more difficult. We talked for, when we were talking about why you needed to communicate or why you wanted to communicate, I believe it was you that suggested that we needed to communicate our feelings about things, sort of know where each other is coming from. And I certainly think that that is very important. And so many of the suggestions, I think, apply best in situations where there is some conflict, but can be elaborated to apply in general in other situations. Something that I found very helpful the first time that I met it, and it may be something that's very familiar to a lot of you, is Dr. Thomas Gordon's notion about who owns the problem. And this, I think this could be very liberating for parents, especially if you really can buy into this and apply it. But he makes a big distinction, or makes a big, or puts a lot of emphasis on who owns the problem, and basically feels that parents trouble themselves a lot more than they have to, because a lot of the things that they deal with are not really their problems. And maybe try to make the distinction for you. If your child is or feels that he has a problem because a need of his is not being satisfied, but that particular need has nothing to do with you, and maybe nothing is a little bit too strong a word, but it's not directly related to you, then the problem is not yours. The most common one of all is brothers and sisters who fight, okay? Because that's not really your problem. It is for your mental sanity, but somehow, but it's not really your problem. It's your child's problem, and you know, I think we could talk about that a long time, but for right now, I just want to give you this model, and then we'll maybe come back to it. But that problem is really your child's. What he does with his brother or sister or his friends or at school, that's another one. Or do you help with the child situation?
You see the blood running.
That's what the book says. I don't know if I can go quite that far. When I hear something hit the wall, I usually get up. Okay. And then he makes a very clear distinction then in the situation, well, two others really, the situation which the child's needs are being satisfied, your needs are not being interfered with, and everything is fine, so nobody has a problem. Okay, perhaps I have a teenager who loves to have friends over. They play the jam box. They play ping pong in the basement. And, you know, we're generally all happy with each other. Nobody gets in each other's way. The third situation is one in which the child's needs are not being satisfied. The child has a problem. But the child's needs interfere with your needs. So then you have the problem. You own the problem. It becomes yours. And an example out of our family is the children coming in from school and leaving their books and their jackets and everything else on the kitchen table. The house we just moved out of, you walked into the kitchen from the carport, and that's where everything went. Okay, so then at supper time, I never could figure out how to handle this very well. At supper time, the stuff was always on the table, so then I had to get them back to get the stuff off the table before supper. But that was my problem, because supper couldn't happen unless the table was cleaned off. Let me read you some for examples, and we'll practice a minute. Okay,
did you solve that by moving? Is that what you said? Yes,
we bought a new house. In this house, you walk into the house into a foyer, and then there's the hall before you ever get to the kitchen. So I fully expect the books to be in the hall. Let me give you a couple of, for examples, and you tell me whether, who owns the problem? Does the parent own the problem, or does the child own the problem? Okay, if your child misbehaves in public when you are present, who owns the problem?
You own the problem.
Does it interfere with you?
Sure
it does.
Sure it does.
But how much it interferes with you is how you perceive things.
All right. You're probably suffering embarrassment, right, because of the fact that the child is misbehaving.
That's true.
So you walk away.
Which is what you're supposed to do.
You're supposed to walk away.
They give you another. If brothers and sisters are fighting, which is the example we used, then who really owns the problem unless it gets violent? The children own the problem. What about misbehavior at school?
Is the teacher's problem?
Does that make it your problem?
Well, if they involve you in it, then you're partially responsible to rectify the things.
That's not easy to do, isn't it? Yes.
I think a lot of times when children are misbehaving at school, it is because there are problems that are not being dealt with at home, and the acting out is a symptom.
Absolutely.
In which case, that is not the real problem.
Right. But as far as the child's behavior at school, I mean, you know, the thing in doing some of the reading that I've done that I've been impressed with is how much emphasis is put on, well, I guess in terms of your goal for your children, what kind of person do you want them to become? But how much emphasis is put on helping children become independent, that has to be our goal, that you start, you know, the beginning of their life is the letting go of it. And I've heard my husband use this example so often. He talks about the prodigal son. He's a religion professor. And he said it was not until our children started to grow up that he could look at that story and appreciate the father, because the father let the son go. You know, so much of this that I've been reading about, the whole parenting thing, talks about our children being independent and wanting our children to be independent. That's a goal, and I really think it is. So if you come back to the school problem, you know, the child may very well have a problem at home, but he also has to learn to get along.
I must think, like in my own case, when I was growing, I don't have kids, but when I was growing up, I had problems at school and ended up going to a school psychologist, which didn't change or help a thing. And it was not until I was an adult and looked back and saw that if the family had gone for family therapy, my problems probably would have cleared up.
Yeah, and I'm sure they are certain.
And so having me try to deal with some of those, it was always a lost cause, because
it was more basic than that. And certainly that's an example when it is more than a child's problem. Okay, that's a nice
question. See, I think if I was a parent, I'd want to know about the problem so I could discuss it at home before it would get out of hand and become so big. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure.
What about homework?
That's their responsibility.
And so, you know, maybe there are some distinctions between behavior in the classroom, misbehavior in the classroom, mm-hmm. and
responsibilities.
Can you give me an example of something that you would like to know about?
Like maybe if fighting in the playground, or kids teasing your child, or your child being mean to someone else or something. I guess I'd want to know about that so I could talk about it. Like why he acted that way.
How
he could have acted instead.
Given him some alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think if you don't talk about that stuff, you know, it can't get out of hand.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And it's hard to know when to draw the line. I mean, when you really is this wrong. The teasing is one that bothers me, because one of our children gets teased a lot. And I don't know how to be helpful. The books say it's his problem.
But if he can talk to you about it, doesn't he feel better about it?
Not really. Because he just he whines and cries and Yes, Mary.
Yeah, I don't mean to throw, I'm a firm believer in homeschooling and the idea of, you know, their problem and our problem. But I think one of the problems with that is that it bears an assumption that if it's the child's problem, that the consequences of the solutions, that there are consequences to the child misbehaving. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes within the school setting or even outside it, the consequences are can be awfully far in the future and cannot always, not that the parent can solve the problem either, but I'm a little wary sometimes of letting the kid go, because I think sometimes the end result is too far away or...
And too expensive.
Yeah, too expensive in terms of the cost. A simple example is you mentioned homework. Some schools, we assume, okay, if the kid's late, for example, or doesn't do his homework, the school will do something about it, the kid will pay a price. But unfortunately, maybe down in South Carolina, it's true, but a lot of other places, there isn't a cost for that. The teacher just says, well, okay, he doesn't do his homework, that's... must come from a rotten family.
And move right along. Yeah. And certainly all of this has to be tempered.
I was just curious, can you ask your child if they want to be helped?
Can you?
Why not? I did it.
And what did the child say?
No, he didn't want help. I knew the problem.
Uh-huh.
And I was aware of it, but I wanted to know, did he want me to help?
Certainly, I think. And I think they may not tell you.
I think that helped.
Because he knew at least you were willing to,
yeah,
to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
I think anything that expresses your concern and care is fine. Yes?
I think there's a degree in problems.
Uh-huh.
And I think there are times when the child should bear the consequences. And then there are other times when they should not. And of course, it's up to parents to have to judge. For example, if a child is in the habit of forgetting their lunch, it really isn't harmful for them to go hungry a day or two. And they'll just eat another extra peanut butter sandwich when they get home or something. Rather than the mother or father, in some cases, always having to remind them
or take
run after them or take it to school.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of when it certainly is.
But where there is possible physical or psychological injury, I think that's just another situation.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I
go ahead. Let me take another comment.
I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with this train of thought, and I'm wondering, does it, if something is not your problem but the child's problem, is that their problem that you don't care at all?
Not necessarily. I think there's some alternatives for what you can do. One is certainly listen.
Uh-huh.
And then you may want to offer alternatives, which is another one, to offer to help the child work through it.
Uh-huh.
So there, you know, certainly there, it's appropriate to do that. But
I tend to agree with what Mary was saying. When you consider that the consequences for certain things can be so far ahead that a child really doesn't feel like being warned of what's occurring, children are after all children.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of will tend to live for the moment. And if you're talking about, say, the sixth grader who decides to not do his schoolwork and not start the school and basically crash his school career, he doesn't realize, you know, what's going to happen
down the road.
As far as what's going to happen to him.
Uh-huh.
In that sense, I can't help but feel that that's my problem too, because
I
have to deal with that in the future.
Down the road. Yeah, that's a tough one, you know, and that, you know, my gut feeling is not where my head is in terms of my inclination to be involved in that. But at the same time, I think that, you know, I know for our sixth grader who had some of those inclinations that, you know, he so desperately needs the independence. He needs to be responsible for himself. And so I really tried to work on that hard this year and had a lot of support from some teachers in working on that too for him. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think generally, if when a toddler has problems, if the parent is continually stepping in and giving solutions, that as that child gets into pre-adolescent and adolescent, you'll find that same pattern there. Mm-hmm. And if you learn it at early time to start saying, and giving all the ums and nothing more, that child begins to solve his own, and it goes with him then as he gets older. It's sure a lot easier to live with.
Sure is. Let me suggest to you, two different sort of structures, I guess, for responding to children that might be helpful in communicating feelings with them and getting around some of these negative kinds of things that we talked about over here in terms of when anger is in the way, in terms of blaming or interrupting or feeling like you have to give advice or belittling a child. In Gonneau's, the book that is about Gonneau really, he talks a lot about it being important to use descriptive language rather than criticizing kind of language. In the session I did earlier in the week, we got into talking about children's rooms. And it seems to be a timely topic wherever you are. Think about the difference in saying to a child, why are you such a slob? As opposed to saying to the child, this room looks like a tornado struck it. The messages are very different. Kid, you're a slob, or this room looks like a tornado struck it. Or another example might be, you must be God's most irresponsible child. I got one, I know. Or you could say to the same child when you come in the door, I don't see any meat thawing on the counter. Which is a different way of saying the same thing to the child. You're still noticing what has not been done, but the implication is very different. So using descriptive language could be helpful. And something I just want to share kind of as an aside, he talks a lot about using descriptive languages in situations where there is conflict involved. But he also talks about the importance of using descriptive languages in positive kinds of communication, too. And I had never thought about this before, until I started doing some of this reading. But suppose that your child, you have a 4 or 5-year-old, and they come to you with a picture that they have done. And you say to the child, you're a fantastic artist. Okay. As opposed to saying to the child, I like that big yellow sun that's coming up over the mountain. Which message do you think is probably more reinforcing to the child? The second one. Why is it more reinforcing?
We don't have to live up to it.
Exactly. They don't have to live up to it. Anytime you put an evaluative comment into what you said, it creates expectations for the child. And, you know, I don't know how many times I've said, I'm proud of whatever, okay? Never thinking that that was a very subtle way of saying, I'm proud of you, and to the child, maybe only proud of me when I do make good grades or do whatever. But I thought that was a very interesting thing, especially in terms of thinking about communicating positive sorts of things to children. All right, let me give you some other sets of messages. And I want you to tell me which one of the two you think you would rather hear. You're the child and I'm the parent. this is a typical family incident. Turn down that TV. Can't you see I'm on the phone? You are so inconsiderate. Or I could say, I feel frustrated when the TV is so loud because I can't hear what my mother is saying. Which one can you swallow better? Absolutely. I feel frustrated when the TV is on, or when the TV is loud, because I can't hear what my mother is saying. All right, listen to these two. It's a dead giveaway, but anyway, another example. I told you to shovel the driveway when you got home. We don't shovel many driveways in San Diego. When the driveway isn't shoveled, I feel frustrated because I can't get the car in the garage. But what's the difference in the two messages? Let's just take the last example. When you say, I told you to shovel the driveway when you got home, as opposed to say, when the driveway isn't shoveled, I feel frustrated because I can't get the car in the garage. What other things are you saying to the child in the process of the lesson?
Well, when you say the second one, you're focusing on how you feel about what he's doing, and you're not putting all the blame on the child. I mean, you're... You're expressing him how you feel.
Right. You are sharing feelings with the child. Exactly. Uh-huh.
What do you do when neither approach works?
I don't know.
I certainly think these are what you try first.
I tried them.
You already tried. Shoot.
I'm not going to have a solution for you. Other comments? Yes.
I don't want it to be my problem of frustration. I want it to be that kid's problem that the driveway isn't shoveled. So I feel frustrated. Big deal. That's my problem.
You put the monkey on your back by doing that, haven't you?
I mean, you should use a lot of I messages, but sometimes I feel like if I get to the point where it looks like I'm always the one who's anxious, upset, frustrated, when it's somebody else that needs to be shaken up.
Okay, that's a good point. It almost is like you're accepting
their problem.
It becomes your problem. Meredith?
But I think the kid, kid hears the message. The message still is the driveway hasn't been shoveled. The kid knows that he had been assigned that task. I think it's simply the old saving face, which is very important. You know, it's not a belittling. You use the I message, you're not belittling, you're giving the child a chance to slither out the house and shovel the driveway without, you know, feeling quite as bad as he would if you started railing at it.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
But just like the muddy floor, the kid really doesn't care if the floor gets muddy after you've mopped it. That's not going to bother. It could stay muddy for 2 weeks, it's not going to bother. Well, a year wouldn't bother. And so when I say to him, that really disappoints me, I feel bad because I really worked hard on that. My child does feel guilty. He does feel a sense of, gosh, you know, this took some effort for her to do this, and here I've, you know, made a mess up. I guess I better help clean it up. And it doesn't work. It didn't work in my family for a while. They just would stand and look at me. But after a few months, they started getting into it, saying, "Hey, she's got feelings too."
I think a lot of this is based on the, you know, the premise that the family unit is working pretty well,
yeah,
and that there is a pretty high level of caring and concern. One of the situations that we didn't really mention that makes communication difficult is when either party involved does not have very good self-esteem. If you say something, you give a you message to someone who doesn't, it, you know, they can respond in several ways. They can become very defensive, which a lot of times evokes then a power struggle. You know, you shovel the driveway, I'm not going to shovel the driveway, and we're kind of in a stalemate. It can be, you know, further damage the child's self-concept in the sense that, I forgot again, I'm supposed to do it, if they really have been conscientiously working on responsibility. So I don't think it's just, and I don't think you can simplify it to the point of saying, you know, it's always going to work or always not going to work, certainly, because there's so many other factors that determine the sort of multiple messages that come across. The thing about the feeling is so important, that as, you know, if a family is truly a caring family, and Satir, in her book called People Making, which is another book that I'm using and it's in the bookstore, talks about families having what she calls open and closed systems. And by system, she really means kind of the rules that run your family, or under which your family operates. But she would say that, you know, that in an open family, that many times an I message is sufficient because there is a certain level of caring and concern among people in the family. The child might be embarrassed enough, they might not do it right then, but they might do it later even, to save face, especially if it's a teen. But, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying, because there are certain times when, you know, you're going to say, this is it. You know, you have to do it or else, and you have to set up something that takes the form of discipline, I certainly think. And we could talk about logical consequences of what else you want to do with a child.
Touch
it. Right. Yeah. You want to say something?
I was just going to say, yeah, I think that part about the open and closed family is important, because you can use I messages to manipulate, too. I mean, if that's your intent, to use an I message to manipulate, that isn't going to come across. Because I had an acquaintance who used I messages all the time, and whenever she did it on me, I
you knew what you were doing.
I'm not another one.
You can, and then it fits with something this lady was saying a while ago, too, that an I message that is not sincere doesn't work. In other words, you can use the I message, but if you really are furious with the kid, I mean, if you can't get yourself far enough away from the situation to kind of look at it analytically and think, okay, the child is not responsible, one more time, I'm going to give him or tell him how I'm feeling about it, it isn't going to work at all, because the child knows you are really PO'd, okay? And no matter what, that comes through, even no matter how you say it, because the nonverbal brings it through.
How bad is it to blow every once in a while?
You know,
and overreact. To me, I don't think that's so bad sometimes. And, you know, this is a big world we live in, and they're not always going to be pussyfooted in this life. Now, I have blown many times, but I have also apologized.
I think that's important.
And, you know, so I don't think it hurt mine.
No, I don't think anger is a very normal, natural thing, and to not express it is certainly worse than to express it.
I think
it.
So too.
It's bad for stomach ulcers.
What is the I messages and, you know, I'm frustrated when this doesn't happen. How does that apply to toddlers, people that, you know, when their thought processes are so different?
How does it keep on spinning?
They still keep spinning in there 3 years old.
That's
what
horrible.
Do you do?
I never.
If you don't stop spinning, you're going to have to whatever.
Why the love? I guess.
Yeah, I guess my friend.
We won't go get the ice cream home today.
And I guess that, you know, you should. The encouragement from my reading, and again, I talk from my head and not from my experience a lot of times, is that the thing to do would make there be some either logical or natural consequence. Okay. If the child spits and it's dirty, then, and you really tried to tell him it bothers you, okay, then what would be a logical consequence to spitting?
Walk away.
Because they want their mother's attention, and if you say, it really makes me angry, I don't like that.
How
How about cleaning it up?
No, I was just going to agree. Everything that's so hard, it's hard as parents for us to accept it, or at least it's for me. But everything kids do, they do, because somehow distorted or weird as we do it, they get reinforced.
Yeah.
You know, for the spitting or the biting, or we don't think we're reinforcing it, but nobody does things if there isn't some, even little kids, if there isn't some reinforcement for it.
One of the, you know, the comments just in reading about the I messages was that they certainly can be overused, and you know when they're coming, and that if they don't work, then you don't keep doing them, because obviously the child, probably they have become for the child a way of getting attention, because they know that, you know, my mommy who's read all these books is going to tell me one more time, I spit, watch me spit. But you're right, and one suggestion is certainly to walk away from that and not to notice it. But after a while, I have a child who burps. So rude. Yeah. Really trying not to ignore it lately. That's my current strategy. I have a strategy for the week. This week it's to ignore it. So if you hear it, I don't hear it.
When my son was very young, he started biting, and it got to be a real big problem. And I went through all the things where how it upset me when he bit, and then I went through, you know, that you really hurt people when you bite, and you know, you wouldn't want to be hurt. And you know, we went through all this explanation, and he kept biting his older sister, and she'd cry, and I knew it was just the butter. So finally, I told her, I said, okay, what you're gonna have to do is you're gonna have to bite him back. And you know, the first time she didn't bite hard enough, and I said, that's not gonna work. I said, you have to bite him. If he bites you, you bite him. Because he started biting other kids. And we've gotta get it stopped. And so I think sometimes you have to, you can try some of the other stuff, and if it stops, great. Sometimes you have to go a little further.
So what is your experience with my oldest son? I heard the baby screaming and went in, and here was these teeth marks deep in the arm. And I said, you mustn't bite your baby brother, it hurts him, he's crying, so on. And it happened again the next day, and I swatted him on his knee a little bit and said, that's naughty, don't do that anymore. The third time I bit him, never bit again. I said, did that hurt? Yes. Then I won't do it anymore, you don't do it anymore. He never did it again.
I read that. That suggestion worked.
This is along that line. You have to be real careful because things can get dangerous. But I heard once that Indians will sometimes let their children, you find out that the fire is something to avoid once you've been burned. And some people will let the kid get burned. But of course you have to have real careful limits on that. But sometimes that is
good. Other comments?
I think sometimes also if you, it was kind of running on the same line that someone else said, if you can sometimes give the child a choice, either you keep spinning and you clean it up each time, well, you give them a choice of continuing to do what you do.
Either not spit or
right,
clean it up.
Right. And in that way, I think it maybe puts more of the responsibility on them because they have to make the choice of what they're going to do. And in the end, perhaps it can foster a little bit more independence as well.
I like to ask my kids what they think the consequences should be, rather than just saying this is what's going to happen. You know, this is the problem, now what do you think we should do about it if it continues? And let them help me make the decision.
And that relates to this, something we really haven't talked about a lot in the examples that we've used is respect. And I think when you involve your children in the decision-making process, you ask their opinions about things, that certainly that conveys to them that you value and you respect
them as individuals. Yes.
That worked well for us. Our children are older now, but that worked well for us because they knew that if they did certain things that were against the rules of the house or whatever, they knew they were going to be in that process of deciding what the punishment was going to be. Mm-hmm. And they knew that when they had to make those decisions, often they chose things mm-hmm. out of default that were much harsher than what we would have done to them.
That's a good point.
That wasn't a problem, mine.
Easy off.
Mine knew that he was breaking the rule and that he was going to pay the consequences. And he'd come in and say, I did it, but it was worth it.
I guess they didn't take the consequences.
I'm ready for the punishment, but it was worth it. What good is punishment at that point? Unless you
maybe have to rethink what the punishment
is. What the punishment's going to be.
If you want to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, in relation to the negotiating problem, I know that with our teenagers, it really worked for us to say, what time do you think you can be in rather than you must be in? And they were, I can honestly say, they were more conservative than I think we would have been.
I think so much of, you know, the underpinning of what we've been talking about, or what can really make a difference maybe that might address some of the concerns that you have, is that we do treat our children with respect. Certainly they're younger, you're talking about young children, certainly they're younger, certainly they don't have the experiences that you do, but if we treat them as friends almost, as you would treat a friend, not as a friend, but with the same degree of respect and consideration that you would treat a friend, some of these techniques will work that might not work under other circumstances because there will be a degree of mutual respect and consideration for each other. And one very simple example is when you get all bent out of shape because the child doesn't knock before they come into your bedroom, but do you knock before you go into your child's bedroom?
Yes.
Okay. That's very simple consideration. And I think you communicate a lot to children when, you know, with behaviors that are so everyday and ordinary, it's hard to sort of step back and take a look at what you're saying. But I guess I'd like us to leave with and kind of, certainly if you have other things to say, but leave with kind of the idea that a very important basis for communication is respect for your children, because they will understand that. And they will be much more likely to regard you with respect and not to engage you in a power struggle or to struggle for your attention in those unpleasant kinds of ways if they know that the respect is there. And it's not always, but more often than that.
I was just going to say something about it depends on personalities, too. And I think that's part of respecting a child with different personalities, too, because I've got a son who's a con man. You know, everything you say, he will try to negotiate it around. And daughter who's just the opposite. And I cannot try to treat them the same.
Sure. I was just going to say, you have friends who are different.
Yeah, right.
And so you treat